This is the 20th season of the Consumed podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Lewis. And this time around, I'm doing a quick retrospective with clips from the over 200 conversations I've had with eaters, drinkers, thinkers, and makers. I certainly can't include clips from all of them, so I stuck with the moments that have stuck with me over the last 5 years. I categorize them by the different kinds of guests I've had, so it's a great way for devoted listeners to look back or for casual listeners to dip in. I have so enjoyed reliving these moments, and I hope you will too. But first, a quick shout out to the Consumed podcast sponsors. Consumed is sponsored by Midstate Containers Cargo Storage Containers and Refrigerated Shipping Containers for sale and rent in California. You may not understand how Midstate Containers could change your life, but the truth is, many, many guests on the Consumed podcast use Midstate for their projects. Containers can serve as wine storage units for case goods, for private collections, and even tasting rooms. They can be refrigerated storage containers for breweries, kegs, and fruit during harvest for wineries. Midstate Containers outfits coolers and freezers for ranchers, farmers market growers, orchards, and butchers. Containers can make great pop-up coffee bars and berry containers for root cellars. My guest from season 10, Krista Flieger from Lonely Palm Ranch, uses her Midstate container for an office on her property. Other ideas include schoolrooms, music and photography studios, and there are other things that can be grown, stored, and processed in a Midstate container, so use your imagination and get on their website to request a quote, midstatecontainers.com. Slow Food Co-op's mission is to empower health and well-being in the community by providing quality groceries, local produce, and exceptional customer service. Slow Food Co-op sources from local producers, ensuring they offer their shoppers great food and household staples. Slow Food Co-op is your friendly neighborhood grocer, maintaining non-GMO standards and a variety of organic selections. You can find Slow's only community-owned grocery store open every day, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., at 2494 Victoria Avenue in San Luis Obispo, California. And check out their website at slowfood.coop. Here's a set of clips from a category that's close to my heart, the media. I've spoken to so many writers, filmmakers, designers, stylists, and publishers about their role in the food and drink space, and these are a few of the ones I've enjoyed most. Like the one I had with Haley Thomas Kane, who wrote the food column for the San Luis Obispo Weekly called New Times for 5 years. I have always loved her writing style. It's smart and scrappy and always with a positive focus. Haley has since moved on to live partly in Detroit and continues to tour and record with her wildly successful band, Haley and the Crushers. Here we talked about the difference between a critic and a food writer.
For listeners that have read my column in the New Times over the past, I guess, 5 years that I did it, they would also say I'm not a critic, and I've gotten flack for not being critical. So I think it's truthful to say that I am, we called me a flavor writer, I think it was my term. And I have two reasonings for this. One, I think philosophically, a critic is someone who is on the sidelines that is not necessarily in the game. And I just don't go with that. I don't jive with that. I feel like we're all in this together, especially artist to artist. I consider myself an artist. Chefs, farmers, these people are artisans, so I can appreciate different things about what they do. So that's just my philosophy as a creative person. Like, I've just never been a critic. Number two, I'm gonna lose my number two. Number two, Slow is a really small community.
Yeah.
I liken it to this. What if Glenn Starkey was doing music critic stuff? Okay, how many albums come out in this town a year?
Right.
A lot. I mean, I guess maybe like 10. Like,
yeah,
big
but not
albums.
Hundreds.
Right. We live in a bubble, and I don't think we're a big enough city or county, really, to have that kind of hand your butt to you and slice into you and say that this service. We don't have career waiters like in San Francisco or New York or Berlin, places where people are waiters for a long time and like the service is very important to them. We don't have that. And part of that, what makes Slow cool is that we are this sort of like open door between cities and people coming through LA and San Francisco and different people finding themselves in the position of being a chef or being an artisan or working in food service.
The stop along the way.
Right. And that's why we love it. And that's why we love interviewing these people, because they've had that big change where they go to slow and they make a new life for themselves. So I think we have a really unique ecosystem. And I don't feel like I was trying to insert myself as the critic of this place and the flavors of this place. I wanted to be more an investigator and to find the humanity behind the food. And that's what I always did. And that's what my readers that, do like me or did like me, that's what they always said. Thank you for showing the story, not just, you know, how was the pork?
Yes, right.
I loved my conversation with Sarah Dieter in the second season of Consumed. She told me about the path that led to her owning the San Luis Obispo design business, Makers and Allies, with her husband, Garrett. They specifically design for the wine, craft, and spirits industry, and everything they do is, like, outrageously gorgeous. Since we met up, Sarah and her team have won numerous design awards, and Sarah gave birth to two beautiful little ones. Oh, how much changes in 5 years, right? But in this clip, we talk about the design process for one wine label in particular, that of Matina Fiore Winery in Santa Maria.
You guys do a lot of gold emboss, which is always really, it stands out. You
know,
you see it on a shelf.
It's so fun. My husband was gold foil for Halloween.
This year?
Yeah. And he just like had all these hilarious puns. He was like, "You want to make your design shine? Gold foil. I'm your man."
It's me. He's like a superhero. Yeah. Well, that Matina Fiore label is so beautiful. It's just different than anything else. And especially at the time that it came out, it was very different from anything else.
For sure.
So with them, I mean, it's, if I'm remembering it right, it's kind of, it almost looks like a Renaissance kind of tapestry feel to it, which is very traditional and old school feeling, but somehow it manages to be very modern too.
Yeah.
So when you built that brand or even just that label, what made you, what brought you to the conclusion that this was the right way to go, where it reflects them?
Yeah. Well, a big part of their history and their heritage is Andrea's kind of Italian background, but also Scott's background in the florist industry. So he grew up in a floral shop, and his sister still has one up in Dixon outside Davis. And so we really wanted to kind of connect those two pieces. And so the actual floral kind of delicate element comes through in the art itself. But then the typography is really reminiscent of kind of old Italian signage. We looked at a lot of Louise Feely books, who's this great New York Italian designer. She's super old school. So pulling some of that typography from the Italian heritage, and then the floral from his background as well.
You might not be familiar with illustrator Greg Clark's voice, but I can guarantee you've seen his work somewhere. His cartoons are instantly recognizable in any of the publications that routinely use his work, like The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Atlantic, Wall Street Journal, Time Magazine, and Rolling Stone. I wanted an excuse to talk with Greg anyway, but when he published the book A Sidecar Named Desire, Great Writers and the Booze That Stirred Them, I found a way to justify having him on the Consume podcast. Here he talks about his favorite drink, the martini, and how authoring this book taught him so much about booze.
Well, it is. It is. It's pure alcohol.
Yeah.
I mean, it's straight gin and a smidge of vermouth.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's definitely the hard stuff.
Yeah, the hard stuff, right?
Yeah.
But I think when you get into things like that with the hard stuff, especially for something as strong as a martini, or as just even as strong as like gin, vodka, whatever, vermouth, it has to be very good. You start to see there's a big discrepancy between good and not so good.
Oh, absolutely.
And you can really see it there because that's all there is. There's nothing that can cover it up.
Absolutely. That's why you want to use the finest gin for a good martini.
Yeah. And what's your brand?
Well, I probably have three top brands at the moment. Bombay Sapphire is my old standby, but currently my favorite is Plymouth, which is another, it's been around for a long, long time. I don't know if it's as old as Bombay, but it's a little less juniper forward than the Bombay. And it's just, it's a very smooth gin. And then another one is The Botanist, which is a Scottish gin.
And kind of, well, it sounds like it's floral. It's herbaceous. It's botanical, obviously.
Yeah, it's really quite something.
Yeah.
Those are my top three. And, of course, you've got to use a very good vermouth as well. Yeah. And in my case, that's Nwali Pratt.
Molly Pratt?
Nwali. N-N-O-I-L-L-Y.
Oh.
And then P-R-A-T.
Okay.
It was T.S. Eliot's favorite vermouth.
Look at all the things you learned, too, through that. I'm sure you just felt like you were learning stuff all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, it was great fun.
Brittany App has lived what feels like three lives in the span of one, and her stories are rich and beautifully told. I invited her to the Consume podcast because she's passionate about the one thing we all need to consume, water. She cares about its history, its culture, its disappearance, and the implications of all of it. She's so passionate, in fact, she made an award-winning feature-length documentary about drought across California called Where There Once Was Water. Here, I ask her about how the idea for the film came to her. It's a long clip and so worthwhile, but we were on Zoom because of lockdown, so, you know, the quality isn't what it usually would be.
How did you, what was the genesis of the project?
Well, you know, I just thought to myself, what's the most expansive topic I could possibly try to make a first film about? God or water? Yeah, let's go with water. So how this started, it's very much tied into how I got interested in water in the first place, you know, as a commercial photographer running around in the world, how does that transition kind of happen? And so the very Cliff Notes version of the story is, I was hired as the shipboard photographer for Semester at Sea, which is a study abroad program on a ship that sails around the world and stops in all these different ports. And then the students on board do their learning in port through different nonprofits or volunteer experiences or wilderness excursions or, you know, depending on what they're studying. And as the photographer, I was sent on a lot of the more humanitarian service-oriented trips, like build houses with Habitat for Humanity in the Kyalicia Township in Cape Town and go trek into the Amazon and help rebuild a little school, you know, way out, a full day's travel from anywhere. And so it was amazing. And literally just plopped me into all of these different places and situations that I would have had a really hard time accessing just on my own.
Yeah.
And it was the first time that I ever experienced what life really looks like in a third world country. Mm. And specifically for the women, and specifically around water. And so I remember on one of these trips, we were kind of coming back. I think we had been repainting an orphanage in a small town in India, right? And we're all on this bus and we're all coming back to the boat, the ship.
Okay, distinction.
I call it a boat. The ship, we're all coming back to the ship. Boats are this big and ships are, and I looked out the window of the bus and we were on this dirt road and it was a real, urban situation, and there's this woman my mother's age and she's squatting on the dirt road and she's doing her family's laundry in this puddle of mud. And it was really the straw that, you know, broke the camel's back for me. On top of everything else I had seen leading up to that point, I was like, you can't do life without water. You cannot do life without water. And the responsibility falls on the women and the girls. And so in a lot of these countries where there is no water and there is no water infrastructure, the little girl's life, as soon as she's old enough to carry, you know, however many gallons on her head, that's her life. And she doesn't get to wear, she doesn't even have shoes, and she's got to walk 5 miles round trip multiple times a day to go fetch water that isn't even clean. And all of that, just seeing it and feeling it and being there, just broke me to pieces. And when I got back home from Semester at Sea, I was like, okay, I need to do something crazy so that I can raise a bunch of money and then I could donate it to a nonprofit that's doing water access. And so I decided, I don't know, maybe I could ride a bicycle across the United States of America. Sure. That's pretty crazy. So I did that and I raised $15,000 and then I donated it to WaterAid, and that at their, you know, price per person, it changed. It provided water for like 500 people for the rest of their life.
Oh my gosh, that must feel so good. I mean,
it feels really good.
Yeah.
But there's still so many more people who don't have water. And it turns out there's 2 million people in the United States that don't have clean running water. And so, to continue attempting to keep this cliff notes, long story short, that was my first like dive into water activism as a photographer, as a storyteller. Then the big mega drought hit in California in 2014. And I was just kind of amazed at the disconnect. Behaviors were not changing, but all of our water was disappearing. And the day I was sitting on my porch and I looked across the street, not out here because I don't have neighbors, but at that time I had neighbors, and I looked across the street and my neighbor was power washing his boat in his driveway. And I was like, oh no. What? So now what am I going to do? So I started a photo project, because I'm a photographer,
right,
documenting all these disappearing bodies of water in California. Because I know the state well-ish, you know, I've grown up here. So I traveled all over the state and it became a very apocalyptic looking photo series.
Yeah.
Beautiful in a really eerie sort of way. This was a lake and now it is, you know, anything but. And at the point where I realized that I had no idea how I was going to photograph disappearing groundwater, I was like, oh, maybe we're going to need to talk about that one.
Right.
Maybe this needs to be a film. Huh. Well, I've never made a film before, but I don't know. I could, you know, figure that out. Maybe it needs to be a film. So I'll do a Kickstarter. And if the Kickstarter is successful, then I'll make a film. And then, as you know, the Kickstarter was wildly successful.
Yes.
And so then, kind of like the bike trip, I was like, well, I guess I'm riding a bike across the country. I guess I'm making a film. And I definitely cast the net far too wide at the start. But it was also a way of kind of finding my story within this giant story.
This next clip is interesting because it comes from someone I hired to help me write my upcoming book. Diane Jacob teaches people how to get published, whether that's a piece in a magazine, newspaper, a traditionally published book, or a self-published book. And specifically, she helps people who are writing about food or drink. If you have a cookbook, memoir, or any other kind of food-related book within you, definitely listen to Diane's full episode. There's a lot to learn from there. In this clip, I ask her how self-publishing is going these days versus traditional publishing.
Well, it's easier than ever to be self-published. Mm-hmm. The woman who just hired me today self-published her first cookbook and has sold 20,000 copies and said that by the end of the year she will have sold 30,000. That is incredible.
That's
well,
really
she's
good.
The one that has 315,000 followers on Instagram.
Yeah.
But obviously she's a really good promoter.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other people who just want to publish their family recipes and couldn't care less how many copies it sells. And there are people who just want to have a book and don't care how many copies it sells. One guy called me one time very early in my career. He called me and he said, I just self-published my book and I have 5,000 copies in my garage. What do I do now?
Oh my gosh. That's my worst, worst nightmare.
That's like, it's a little late to ask that question, buddy.
Yeah. Get ahead of it, man. Wow.
Light a match. Give donations to the library. I don't know.
A bonfire.
Bonfire, yeah. Bonfire would be good.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. So, you know, people self-publish for all kinds of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a completely different business than traditional publishing, which, you know, which is mostly held by gigantic international companies and that make millions of dollars.
That's it for this quick stroll down memory lane on the Consumed podcast. To hear these interviews and many others, head to letsgetconsumed.com where you can search and peruse episodes, see photos, and get recipes. You can also sign up for the Consumed newsletter list, which offers updates on the podcast, more recipes, and even more than that. Special thanks to Chris Lambert for doing the original editing on all these episodes, and to Alexandra Wallace for the lovely collage celebrating the 20th season. Until next time, I'm Jamie Lewis.